Hi folks, this is just a short podcast I recorded myself with Wendy Lyon, the Human Rights and Immigration Solicitor. It's a terrific chat with insight into the refugee asylum process, the iniquities, inequalities and issues with it, and the great work that she does to try and help people who get access to justice. We are doing a live podcast tomorrow evening with Emmett Kirwan. That's Wednesday the 13th. If you want to come along, you can register at patreon.com/tortoiseshack. And we should hope to see as many of you can there. It helps us keep the show on the road and touch base with you, our listeners. Thanks for your support. Talk to you all soon. Thank you.
Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves and today we are talking immigration. I was going to say, as always, I'm joined by my co-host, but I'm not. He's off still. It's nice that we get these breaks, these intermittent breaks. He spends more time in hospital these days than he does on the pod. And it's actually good for my mental health that we get these breaks. But I will say that he's not here, so you don't have to listen to him make a bad buy us a cup of coffee on patreon.com/tortoiseshack. You just have to hear me do it that way and awkwardly. Much more importantly, we are delighted to be joined by Irish Immigration and Human Rights Solicitor Wendy Lyon. Wendy, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you for having me.
Listen, I've been chasing this conversation for a while because obviously the Irish immigration system at the best of times didn't work very well. Do you want to just sort of give listeners an idea of the work that you actually do?
Deal with almost all kinds of immigration issues, from refugee and asylum seekers to people with work permits to family members of Irish EU nationals.
You're lame.
Basically any kind of immigration matter I would deal with. Most of my clients would be more of the less privileged, and I don't really do things like, you know, business immigration visas and stuff.
Yeah. When you say that, you what you actually mean is you represent people who may not have access to as easy access to justice. And we always say on this, I'm reminded, if you can't attest a right, you don't have that right, you know, and, the work you do in that space is critical. Can I just for example, you know, we talk about direct provision and we've seen now, I saw someone actually make a point, a journalist make a point last week that it was a huge shift in this new, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael proposal for government, where they said to move towards ending direct provision. Can I ask you, is that really a seismic shift?
Well, it certainly would be if that's what they plan to do, but I have to say I'm extremely skeptical of that. They were asked, I think they were asked by the Greens if they would commit to ending direct provision. And initially they said yes, and then they started immediately talking about the report, you know, for what it is. It's purely just a reformist document. It absolutely does not envisage ending direct provision at all. It's more about making it, you know, maybe less horrible than it is now. And that's all well and good, but that's definitely not what campaigners like Massey, you know, are aiming for.
I mean, I would have thought, when you think about it in the grand scheme of things, some of the stuff that you guys, and you mentioned Massey, and they do terrific work, but yes. What you still work, the stuff you see, mm-hmm. They're not just, it's not just an immigration issue, it's a human rights issue.
It is, because I mean, there are plenty of people in direct provision who didn't immigrate here. I mean, they were born here. They're growing up here. Their parents may have immigrated here. Although, you know, there are children in direct provision who may have an Irish parent as well. You know, I've had clients in that situation, you know. I think I think in the long run, we are going to have a really serious problem with these children that have been growing up in direct provision in a type of institutionalized living, which is, you know, completely unnatural and completely unlike what everybody else in Ireland is used to. And if people think that's not going to affect them in some ways.
These are life limiting experiences people are having.
Imagine growing up in a country as wealthy as Ireland, you know, where you're in school with people who are going on skiing holidays, you know, and you can't even go to Wales, you know, because you actually are not even allowed to leave the state. You know, you can't even go to Belfast, you know, if you're an asylum seeker. You know, and children know that they're different, you know, and one thing that I do get a lot is, you know, when parents come to me when their child gets to be, you know, a certain age, like 9, 10 years old or whatever, and starts to really realize that they're different, you know, and it's very, very hard on them. Why can't I do these things that my friends are doing? Why can't I go on these trips?
And like, again, I'm reminded, obviously, of that awful referendum we had where we took away the rights for children who were born here. And it's I believe it's to our shame that we did this on the myth of, oh, sure, there are people getting pregnant and getting on a plane and flying over here to have these anchor children was the horrible phrase that was used.
I mean, it's, you know, and it's not as if there aren't children in America who were born in similar situations from Irish parents.
Yeah, very true. You know? Very true.
You know, and that's a big hypocrisy that really, really bothers me as well, seeing the way that people here and the government here will go all out about trying to get, you know, legalize the Irish, and yet they don't see the same thing.
No, we don't even say really legalize. We just say regularize, or we say,
Yeah, well, legalize the Irish. This was about maybe 10 years ago. That was the phrase. But
yeah. I just find, you know, it's the same mentality. There's an old colonialism or imperialism in the language of, you know, how people can be expats and other people can be immigrants, and very much there's a difference between, and then there's that these things are, we do have our own prism that we look at the world through. But can I ask, in terms of the system itself, you will hear all of these edgelords tell us that, you know, sure, look, all of these cases that go to the judge, you know, 86% of them aren't entitled to, if they're seeking refugee status, they're not entitled to refugee status. And if the system was any good, it would just turf them out. The problem is the appeals process and this sort of stuff. What's the truth of that?
Okay, well, first of all, just one thing that I really want to knock on the head, this idea that you get endless appeals. It is not true. It has never been true. There is one appeal allowed in the asylum system, and that is it. And that has always been the case. I'm not sure exactly where the myth came from. I think, you know, maybe some people are confusing the appeals process with the judicial review process. Judicial review is something that it's not an appeal. It's, you know, you can only judicially review a decision if the decision maker actually misapplied the law, you know? Okay. So that's a very different thing from, you know, just thinking, oh, they got my decision wrong. Okay. And even judicially reviewing something is not that easy. It's, you know, you can't just do it as of right. It's certainly not something that you could really blame for holding up the system, to the extent that people seem to believe it is. In terms of just this whole 86% number, whatever number it is they're throwing around these days, one thing that a lot of people don't realize is that, like, to have a successful refugee decision, there's very, very narrow definition of a refugee. So you have to be at risk because of your race, religion, political views, nationality, things like this. You know, you could be coming from like a totally war-torn country.
Yeah.
You know, where there are bombs falling in your neighborhood all the time, and yet you might still not be entitled to refugee status. You know, so just because somebody gets refused doesn't mean that they don't have a genuine fear for their life. They could be they could be refused on the basis that, you know, there's another part of the country, you know, 800, you know, miles from where they live, where maybe they could live safely.
Yeah. And if that's, and so there's, is this an international definition of a refugee, or is this kind of just our own?
It's the Geneva Convention. It's international law.
Yeah, I only ask because that was my thinking on it, but I've also understand the ability that, you know, when the words are easily I mean, as you said, you know, the first place where they could see safe haven was, you know, over the border somewhere else. That doesn't necessarily, you know, it shouldn't end there.
No, there's absolutely no requirement that you seek safe haven in the first country that you go to.
Yeah, there's just so many myths about this, you know, oh, leave them there, send them back. I suppose, like, I mean, it's obvious to me, like, you spoke about the children understanding that they're different. There are literally people living large portions of their lives in these centers. And I hate the word centers, but that's what they term them. And as I've been to them, and I didn't find it a pleasant experience. I found it an upsetting experience. So, just in terms of the actual, how do people, first of all, like how you work with Massey, they try and help get people in touch and we can represent them. Is there a better system? Are the states supportive of people being able to attest their rights, or are there barriers to getting that justice?
Huge barriers. The legal aid system is quite atrocious here.
Okay.
One of the big things, this is something that I think really needs to be looked at, even for refugee status. There is a legal aid system available, but it's very poor. It's very limited as to what is actually covered by it. So, for example, when you're filling out your original application for refugee status, when you're filling out your questionnaire, you know, an 84-page questionnaire, you're not entitled to have a legal advisor there to help you with that. When you go to your interview, and this interview can last for hours, you can have somebody, you can bring somebody there with you, but legal aid won't pay for it. And sure. Yet whatever you say during that interview is going to come back on you, you know? Yeah. I mean, the High Court even ruled, you know, a year or two ago that in a case where a solicitor tried to get the notes from the interview, before a decision was made, the High Court said no, because you're not entitled to these because you could have just gone to the interview with them.
Yeah.
But of course, like, if somebody is not legally aided, they're not going to be able to get a lawyer to go with them. And in fact, if I'm acting for somebody under the legal aid scheme, if they want to pay me to go to that interview with them, I can't do that. But like, that would actually be a breach of my terms and conditions as their legal aid representative. I can't take extra money from them for anything. So, you know, what ends up happening here is that a lot of people don't go without any representation, or they end up paying a private solicitor who will be able to do that for them. And, you know, most people aren't going to have that kind of money if they're in the system.
I mean, I've spoken to obviously a few people who are in the Direct Provision Centre, and there's even a famous case, I'm sure you're aware of, someone who came back and revisited and said, oh, one of the things she said at this in this interview turned out to be false, and then therefore almost everything else this person's ever said in their lives must be false. And you know,
yeah, this is the thing. There's all sorts of, I have to say, the decisions are not now as bad as they were. You know, even when I started doing this, the decisions were much worse. They are getting better trained now. There were some people who were involved in the decision making process earlier on who simply should never have been allowed anywhere near the process, and fortunately, they're not there anymore. But it's still the case that, you know, to a lot of extent, when you get a hearing date for your client, and the first thing you do is you look at who the tribunal member is, and then sometimes you're like, oh God.
Yeah. I don't, obviously we won't talk specifics and stuff, but just in terms of the listeners, just to give them an idea of how difficult it is for someone who is trying to, I suppose, you know, who's had a unsuccessful claim and then has to seek, you know, either an appeal or then a jurisdictional review, if that's the correct phrase. Apologies if I'm butchering that. How, you know, these cases, as you said, you know, it may actually be something where you need to prove that they meet a definition where someone has already said that. How difficult is it?
Well, like for the appeal, you have your one appeal and that's as of right. And a lot of cases do get overturned on appeal, you know, so you can lose in the first round and then still get a positive decision on appeal. That does happen quite a bit. If you have to go to judicial review, that's a lot tougher. As I said, most cases you won't even be able to get there because you can't judicially review it unless there was some kind of unlawfulness in the decision-making process. So say, you know, if like there was a case, an unbelievable case really a few years ago where the applicant was judged on the basis that he was from Sudan when he was actually from South Sudan.
Okay.
That doesn't happen very often. More often it's a case where they simply apply elements of the law incorrectly. You know,
yeah.
But even then, there's a fairly high threshold. There's quite a number of barriers to entry, even to bringing things into the courts. And here again, this is something where it is almost unique to immigration cases. There's a separate court for the immigration. There's a separate immigration court. They're not heard in the ordinary judicial review courts. And most cases in those courts, there's a much stricter time limit to bring the case. There's a higher threshold to get leave, you know, to get the leave of the court to bring the case. And what I think is particularly concerning is that if you lose your case in the high court, you can't just appeal it to the court of appeal like you can for almost any other type of high court case. You have to actually get the approval of the judge who refused you to appeal their case, your case.
That's so mad, isn't it?
I think most people would say that, you know, there's something very, you know, instinctively wrong with this. If the judge refuses you a certificate of leave to appeal, then you can ask the Supreme Court to overturn that decision. But the Supreme Court can only overturn that decision if they decide that there's a matter of national public interest in it. Mm. So, you know, it can't be simply a case of the judge got it wrong. You know, if it's maybe the judge got it wrong, but it's not going to matter to anybody else but you, then forget it. You cannot appeal.
Yeah, that's, imagine if it was just a dispute in the workplace and you and a line manager and you had to dispute the line manager and then you said, we need someone else to adjudicate on this. And the line manager said, no, I've already found in my favor. It just seems to be a bit mad. I'm struggling on how to phrase these questions because I know it's sensitive, but these cases, we see them all the time. And unfortunately, too often we see this ridiculous scenario where it ends up being an appeal on social media to keep such and such here. Mm-hmm. And we see these school children campaigning to keep their friend. This can't be sustainable. Surely we shouldn't. We all pat ourselves on the back and say, "Oh, it's great. He's staying, or she's staying." But surely that's not the way to do things.
No. I mean, it's not. It shouldn't have to be that way.
Is there going to be in terms of, they say, the reforms? What reforms would you like to see? Obviously, I'd just like to see the end of the direct provision.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, like, I wouldn't even know where to start, you know. There's so many things that need to be done so differently. I'd say, for one thing, root and branch, like, replacement of everybody involved in the system, you know, at the moment. Like, there's an entire culture within the department that I think just doesn't care, you know. It doesn't care about immigrants. It doesn't want, like, they don't want to be doing this. I'm sure they all want to be in a different department. They don't put the resources into it. The department doesn't, you know, the resources aren't given to them. Decisions are taking years and years and years that there's absolutely no reason they should take years and years. You know, why should it take? It's like a year and a half to get a decision on a visa appeal. Why does it take a year and a half to get a decision on a visa appeal?
None of that makes any sense.
It makes no sense whatsoever. I mean, I actually cannot fathom what is going on in there that makes that take that long.
Can I ask, given we have to, everything is now viewed through the prism that is COVID-19, and we have seen stories in direct provision centres, and again, I hate this terminology, but nonetheless, of, you know, you can't social distance when you're in these situations, and what are you seeing and hearing at the moment?
Well, there's a lot of people that are absolutely terrified. There's a lot of people that are still being forced to share spaces with multiple people who are not members of their family. Mm. Apparently you're regarded as a household just because you happen to have been sharing a room with somebody.
Yeah.
There are people who have serious conditions where they ought to be, you know, they're the type of conditions that if they were living out in, you know, normal society, they would be told to cocoon. And yet they're sharing bathrooms with other people and, you know, still being forced to eat in collective situations. Yeah. And then we have what's going on in Katarzyna, where, you know, apparently the people are actually being locked in and not even allowed to leave, which is quite. That's,
like, I mean, I've seen Mick Clifford has written recently about the situation there, and other journalists have. And I suppose some of the other stories, though, when you think about it in terms of there are people who are healthcare workers who are living in these centres who are going to work in some situations, and we're telling them that not only that they're not even, like, I know. I was Patrick Frayne wrote a piece about people who weren't even regularized. We use the words, you know, it's absolutely, it's devastating. Imagine saying people need to be regularized. I suppose in a broad question here, so feel free to just tell me to go and help. How badly do we treat immigration here as a country? You know, is it a class issue really?
Well, I mean, there's a class element to it, but it's, you know, it's much more complicated than that. You know, there's still this kind of little Irelander mentality, I think, among certain members of the public, really, and as well as the civil service. You know, I don't think it's necessarily as bad as it is everywhere else. Some of the horror stories I hear coming from, you know, colleagues in the UK are just, you know, sometimes I read things that they share on Twitter and I just think, you know, bad and all as it is here, that would probably never happen, you know?
Yeah. I hate the idea though that the bar is so
exactly,
low.
Yeah. I mean, certainly like, I don't agree with saying like, well, we're not as bad as them, so we're okay, you know?
Yeah.
You know, why can't we be setting the standard of good practice?
Yeah, in terms of so last thing, I suppose in that sense, good practice would obviously mean proper timeframes that are adhered to, where you have a good turnaround, and this would move a lot smoother. What would be, you know, what do you think is a fair time for someone to arrive, claim status, be processed, and failing application to be appealed? Like, this should be what, 6 months, 9 months?
Well, I mean, I don't really like to put a particular time frame on it, because it's, you know, obviously different cases are going to involve different.
Yeah. I asked the question, Wendy, I'm sorry now, but I asked the question, I realized it was a stupid question, because I've spoken to Caoimhe Butterley, and she talks about people who arrive and they're dealing with traumas. And imagine me telling them then, oh, well, the clock starts ticking and you've 6 months. So I understand.
Yeah. There is that. But what I just think is more important is that people need to have the supports that they need right away. You know, people should be as soon as they arrive and claim asylum, they should immediately have, you know, access to legal advice. They should immediately have access to whatever healthcare they need, you know, all of these things. And we're just not providing them, you know, to the extent that that really need to be provided to, you know, ensure a human rights compliant system.
Yeah, and it's funny how these things all interlink. And we spoke to Matthew O'Toole, who's been, you know, who's gone to some of these places to meet people as and give them, deliver healthcare. But that's not, I don't want to stress, it's not the HSE providing, it's things like things like Safety Net and...
I sent a lot of people to Safety Net because that was the only way that they could get any kind of... You know, even to get a referral to Spirosity or something for trauma counseling, you know.
No, I just, we always say the gap has been left there. There are people stepping up. There are people like yourselves who are representing people who are, you know, denied justice. And then there are medics and GPs who are stepping up and doing it as well. But I just, you know, it strikes me very much that this should be a state process and not reliant on this kind of, I kind of use the word altruism. I don't know if it's the right word, but nonetheless. Wendy, just very final thing for me. If we had a magic wand in this next program for government, are there a couple of things that you think should be, you'd like to see actually written in or targets or ambitions?
Well, I mean, the problem is even to say an ambition is it's always setting the bar a bit low because, you know, I mean, I'll be perfectly honest, I'm pretty much a knee jerk, no borders person, you know, and I just like to get rid of the whole system. I just like to be doing a different job basically, you know?
Yeah.
In terms of the things that I think, you know, are practically achievable with a bit of will, certainly improving the legal aid system, you know, so that people have proper legal aid throughout the process here is one thing that needs to be looked at urgently. Mm. There needs to be a proper getting not on the subject of asylum at the moment, but just the ordinary immigration system, an independent appeals procedure. Is something that is really, really needed because right now we have a situation where if you appeal a decision of Inish, you're just appealing to a higher ranking officer within the same unit.
Mm-hmm.
So, and a lot of the negative decisions that we see, they're made because of policy, you know?
Yeah.
Like there are decisions that are taken, which are probably in breach of the law, but they're taken as a matter of policy. So when you appeal it, you're simply going to get it upheld on appeal, and then you have nothing to do but go to the courts. The amount of money, honestly, people have no idea. People really have no idea the amount of money that this government spends on paying people like me, lawyers. The amount of legal fees that the state pays out in immigration cases is astonishing. And half the time, I swear they know that what they're doing is illegal, and they know they're going to end up paying it.
Sometimes, Wendy, they call that. Is that called the push factor?
I often
say that there's a cost of spite and there's an economic incompetence to what we do, you know, and I agree with you. I just think the idea, we've done a lot in here on what Martin would call bogus self-employment. And, you know, you would talk about how a lot of the practices that go on there are actually cost the state more because we're effectively doing ourselves out of tax and PRSI from employees. So, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of this just comes down to sort of, you know, there's just this like absolute terror within this department of like, oh, we don't want to look like we're soft touches, you know, and they would rather spend the money and have the courts tell them you have to do this, you know, rather than at least that way they can blame somebody else.
Absolutely.
It ends up costing the state more to do it that way, you know?
I just thinking of what you said at the beginning of this there, though, which is quite funny because we're both sitting here thinking, you know, I'd be very much of that kind of open borders thing, and people don't understand. They think that people hear that out loud and they think that means everybody's going to just go, you know, the whole world's going to go mad. It doesn't happen. That's not how it works. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the globalization, the polarization, it's a worrying time because we are seeing that the climate crisis is a migration crisis.
Yeah.
And we need to get this right now. We can't actually keep this going because this is only going one direction. There's, you know, I think the statistic I got today was for every 1%, a 1 degree rise that nearly a billion people could be displaced.
Yeah.
You know, people like Wendy Lyon are going to be very busy unless we can get our house in order, folks. Wendy, thanks so much for taking the time. I appreciate the work you do. The guys you work with, the people you do, it's essential work. I just think, it doesn't get enough credit, but unfortunately it's necessary still, yeah. And it'll be necessary for a while.
I just think it's so great finally that Massey have come into being and are there doing such fantastic work, because most people wouldn't have had a clue of how bad things were in direct provision, you know, until they got together. And I don't think it's any coincidence that the whole thing really only sort of took on steam once there was actually a user group, you know, a group of people that were actually affected by it. So
I
want to give them huge amounts of credit for
we'll end it with basically, folks, if you want to see any more or you want to help those guys, you can go to massey.ie and you can volunteer, you can chip in, you can even throw them a few bob. They're doing great work, and it needs to be supported. Wendy Lyon, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thanks for having me again.